They call us the irregulars, but baby, we're always on time. Baker Street babes always leave the rest of them behind. Oh. So when Scotland Yard they send you home, you feel like you're losing your quotidian world has got you crying. Won't you two unwind?
Welcome to episode 19 of the Big Street Babes podcast, John Watson Appreciation. First off, I want to give a very sincere thank you to everyone who sort of rushed to our need for bandwidth. I posted the plea at 2 a.m. I got a text from Marie at, 8:30? And I checked, and we had raised more than enough overnight in 6 hours. And people have continued to donate, and I just want to let everyone know that it is so very appreciated. If you did donate, I'm going to attempt to get, cards out or something to each and every one of you. I'll track you down, even if I only have your names. But yes, thank you so much to everybody who even just, showed your support. We got some really sweet notes. Yes, thank you. I won't cry, except I cried last episode, and then people sent me messages saying, oh my god, you made me cry, and I felt sorry. Including all of you. Also, there's this cool thing called a sponsor, and we have one now. The Baker Street Journal, which is sort of the epic Trulockian journal of the Big Street Irregulars. Amazing, amazing guys there, Stephen Doyle and Steve Rothman. We love you! thank you for sponsoring us, and everyone needs to go subscribe because they do really freaking awesome things. I don't know, Lindsay, do you want to expand a bit more on that? Because I'm just going to keep saying awesome all the time.
Sure. Yeah, no, the BSJ is amazing. I'm going to forget to whom to attribute this quote, but never has so much been written by so many for so few. It's all either scholarly articles or shout-outs to brilliant new Sherlockian material or reviews of new Sherlockian content. They're really comprehensive, and literally, we should make this clear, anyone who wants to contribute material to the Baker Street Journal is welcome to submit articles. There was a lovely girl in college who submitted one last year. The year before, we had a high school participant who submitted an article that was ultimately printed in the journal because it was just amazing and it was fantastic. So if anybody would like to take a stab at writing for the journal, that's also fantastic. And subscribing to the journal is just, it's really worthwhile to see all of the writings about the writings as they come out. Yeah, Steve Rothman, the editor, is a fantastic guy. He wears bow ties at every formal event, which is wonderful, and he's a Natalie dressed gentleman. We love him. And Steve Doyle, he is the author of Sherlock Holmes for Dummies. So, you know, some awesome sauce there. And the BSJ has been running a very long time. It also puts out a Christmas annual that's regarding a particular topic. It changes every year. Yeah, they're awesome.
Yes, and in the spring one, there's an interview with me. Christmas Ribbon has interviewed me about the Babes. And we're also writing an article about the Believe in Sherlock campaign, which is going to be awesome and has been awesome.
I think I have an article in the spring one, too, actually. Ooh. So, yeah. Babes everywhere.
So, with that out of the way, it is John Watson time. Today, we have Amy, Maria, Taylor, Caffers, Artie, Lindsay, Marie, and Sarah, and me.
Woo!
Yay!
So, we are sans Turk and Jen, but otherwise, we're all here, all ready to get around and behind or in front of or under John Watson.
And we are from three continents.
Three continents. I have an intro that I wrote, so get ready for this.
Take it away.
Yeah, I am. Shut up. This episode is dedicated to John Watson, the steadfast soldier and friend, to the man who is always there, even to the bitter end. He is the man who is a friend. That was an unintentional rhyme.
I thought you were going for a poem there.
You accidentally rhymed.
Hold on. Shh, 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 shh. He is the man who is a friend to Sherlock Holmes, the man who calls him out on being an annoying dick, and the man who believes in him. John Watson is more than the everyday man. He is each and every one of us, the audience surrogate, taking us along on the wild ride of misadventures in and out of London. He is the best friend of the cleverest man in the world, the healer, the soldier, and the lover. He is John Watson, and we fucking love him.
Hell yeah!
We have to earn our explicit tag.
Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah.
So, as a precursor, Kaffers has not seen the Reichenbach fall. So, if she dramatically makes an exit, it's because we've kicked her out, and then she'll come back.
Thank you for, like, introducing a lot of fandom hate onto me. I would like to point out that I am in the final semester of the last year of my degree, so I am very fucking busy right now. And the fact that I'm here doing this podcast shows my dedication to you guys quite a bit.
Well, if you can be on the podcast, you can watch Reichenbach. Ooh!
La 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 la, I'm not listening to you.
Okay, so we have, like, a bunch of questions and stuff from audience members. I wish we had, like, a buzzer that people could buzz in and answer. What's an
Darien Adler ringtone.
Yes, that's it. All right, if you want to answer a question, you have to moan. We would like to make any older men aware that are listening. Please have aspirin nearby, just in case. We are cheeky today, my goodness. Or rather, I am. I may have been drinking water.
John Watson brings this out in us.
Okay, so if you want to answer the question, you have to moan. Irene Adler asked.
You're not serious.
No, I'm completely serious. So the first one is a bit long, so don't moan right away. I'll let you know. It is from the amazing Mazarin221B. The characterization of John Watson as a bumbling, unintelligent, silly older man seemed to have been rampant for many years. Any idea where it originated? I could, if I were cruel, point the finger at the Basil Rathbone movies, but I'm guessing it was even before that. But it's affected so many people's view of Watson, and it pains me. Thank God that's been rectified in the last few incarnations, Law and Freeman in particular. But Hardwick and Burke helped start the transformation.
And then no one wants to moan.
Lindsay!
I think we can actually lay the blame for this squarely at the feet of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, because he referred to John Watson as Holmes's rather stupid friend.
Yeah.
So I think that he was the first one to undervalue the narrator that he himself had created, if we're going to go all the way back to it. But the filmed adaptations that were very, very popular in the 1940s and the late 1930s, the Rathbone and Bruce ones, I think that those were so popular, they didn't really help matters. Although in Bruce's defense, I would like to just sort of toss out that although he is not as intelligent as the Watson in the 60 canon stories, he is extremely loyal and quite brave. And so those two aspects of the Nigel Bruce character. He's also very kind in a sort of avuncular way. So I think that there are ways in which the Bruce characterization actually works if you just sort of skip the fact that he exists more or less to slip on banana peels. But he's ready with the service revolver and, you know, he deeply cares about his friend, etc.
Yes, good answer.
Can I add something?
Yes.
Please.
Okay, I think this has to do with partly the way that we're seeing a dynamic more recently with a more, as we talked about last time, you know, you can almost say Holmes has some autistic qualities. Watson is the more normal one. I think at the beginning when the stories were written, it seems like from some of the research that I've done that there was more of seeing Holmes as the hero, Watson as Lindsay said, Conan Doyle said, as the less intelligent friend. Well, I think nowadays, the modern view of Holmes, we've sort of detected his psychology more, and we put more names to some of his sort of oddities, and we look at the two of them now, and we go, yeah, but Watson, from modern standards, is more well-adjusted, he's more successful, and so I think that the way that the portrayals have changed kind of reflect our changing view of what's normal and what's desirable, maybe.
Very good point.
Catherine.
Hello. I was just thinking about, before we started this podcast, that I think one of the first people sort of point out that discrepancy between John Watson in the books and in sort of popular media was Kate Beaton, if any of you have read the Hark a Vagrant comic.
I love Hark a Vagrant.
Fantastic, especially the ones about Vikings. I love them. But she obviously came up with, if any of you have seen, will have seen the memes around the internet of the stupid Watson, who sort of appears and loves jam.
That's where the whole jam thing comes
from. Yeah, that's where the jam. If any of you are wondering where the jam thing comes from, it's the Kate Beaton comic about stupid Watson. She, like, obviously is very sharp-witted in that way and points out, you know, that the actual portrayal of Watson isn't quite what people see in popular media. As I think probably the one where I first became aware that there was a bit of a discrepancy between how he was portrayed.
Yeah, and well, I think just because the Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce adaptation was, like, the iconic one for so long. Like, that's what a lot of people, their first introduction was. And I know, like, this isn't just because I'm obsessed with it, but The Great Mouse Detective, when they talk, when they have their own portrayal.
I was thinking of that, too.
Thank you. David Q. Dawson, it's based off of Nigel Bruce's
absolutely.
Watson. And they even have, like, the voiceover of Bruce and Rathbone, like, actually in the animated film. So, like, as a kid, that's your first introduction. So I grew up thinking that Watson was this bumbling little idiot. Adorable, full mustachioed. I thought he was a mouse for a long time, but, you know, that's what happens when you're a child.
Yep. So, it's sort of held over into the 70s as well, because you had Murder by Decree with James Mason playing a very charming and sweet John Watson, but considerably older, and again, this sort of avuncular, kindly, but slower version. And there's this amazing gag scene in which he's trying to eat peas at dinner at 221 Baker Street. Do you recall this? And he's trying to get them onto his fork. And at one point, Holmes is being played by Christopher Plummer in this film. He reaches over, smashes the pea with Watson's fork and hands it to him. And Watson just looks him in the eye and says, "I don't like them smushed." And it's so domestic and kind of adorable. But Watson's staring, or excuse me, Holmes is staring at Watson as if he has two heads, because really, like, who would go to this amount of trouble for peas? But it's sort of, that's the jam Watson again, and it was still going on in the 70s and then, you know, forward. I think until the Granada version came along.
Yeah.
I have to just add this little anecdote. He also says, particularly in that scene, to smash a man's pee.
Yes!
And when I was 5, I said that all the time because of them.
It's really
a story my grandmother tells me.
God,
to smash a man's pee.
Lots of
appalled
by this. Oh, that's great.
It kind of makes you wonder, though, like, if they were actually thinking about the characterization at all, because why would one of the most intelligent men in the world hang around with someone who is a complete idiot?
Yes.
Like, he often goes on about how much he hates people. Like, why does that even make sense? There must have been something else about his character that made Sherlock go, "Oh yeah, definitely, he's the one I want to live with. He's such an idiot, he'll be a great companion." it's like, what were they thinking?
It's more about Holmes actually looking more intelligent than. It's easier to make him look intelligent if his psyche is kind of not as much.
But do you need to look that much more intelligent than the book?
I say, if Watson was really that dumb, Holmes would have gotten rid of him a long time ago.
Yeah,
you know?
Picked him to the curb.
You would have just been like, "Can't take it anymore, go away.
You and your peas."
It's all you talk about.
How long before a trope becomes something that you start fitting back on to the original? Like, it becomes so attached to it that they're inseparable. It's like, then when you think back to the original, it's like you almost fit that trope back on top of it, even if it's kind of ridiculous in some ways.
Well, thank you, Mazarin, for the delightful question. This one's just silly. Do all of the Watsons have mustaches? Is this what we can expect in season 3 of mustachioed BBC John Watson?
Oh my god, no.
God, no, don't do that, please.
I think I would have a heart attack. No offense to Martin Freeman, but we've seen that happen before, and it wasn't a good idea. I'm sorry, but no.
I think I would actually really laugh if The Empty House starts with him with a mustache.
It would be amazing. Just for one take, and then we see him shave, but that would be amazing. I
think the best thing would be if it's Sherlock himself that makes him shave. It's just like, no, get rid of it. Right. It's not working for you, John.
It can be the equivalent of a crisis cut. My best friend has died. You know, the world has collapsed. I'll grow a mustache. Why not?
Yeah.
And then he realizes that that's not working either. This is a bad move of coping.
The facial hair is a symbol of his emotional problems.
I wanted to have, like, full mutton chops then.
Oh my god.
It could start with a costume party, and then he could totally have, like, the full fake facial hair.
Like, big 70s mutton chops.
I do find it interesting that the mustache is so... It's such an iconic thing for Watson, because Doyle never tells us what the guy looks like, except in The Adventure of Charles Augustus Milverton, where we have this sort of extrapolated impression of what Watson looks like, because Lestrade is describing the perpetrators of the crime to Holmes, which is in fact Watson. And then Holmes says, oh, Lestrade, that's ridiculous. You might be talking about Watson. But that's literally the only time that we get to hear from the horse's mouth what John Watson looks like. He's a complete cipher in terms of looks for the rest of the series. We learn that he has a thick neck, a mustache that he's strongly built, and that's it.
That's all we got.
Yep.
That was from Words Between the Lines on Tumblr. So thank you for that mental image. You've scarred and killed Marie.
I can't even talk anymore.
On the Baskerville commentary, they actually talk about facial hair because the major in it has beard, and he couldn't actually have that if he was in the army. But back in the day, in Victorian times, having a mustache was a mandatory thing in the army. Right. Partly where the mustache comes from. Yeah.
You had to have a mustache.
Yes, yeah. That is why all the Watson have mustaches.
That's my Doyle. Yeah.
But what if you could, what if like some guys just can't grow facial hair?
Challenge, you're in trouble. Well,
you end up with that kind of facial pube look. Obviously, they kicked them out of the army. That's how they found out, you know, if you were a real man, can you grow a mustache?
Can you grow a mustache?
And if you can't grow a mustache, you have no place in the British Armed Forces.
This is all true.
Guns don't kill people. People with mustaches.
That's just John Watson's, like, tagline.
This is all about the fabulous mustache.
The mustache. Mm-hmm. Moving on. Next question is from My Funny Little Brain. In the BBC Sherlock series, do you think John has given up his profession as a doctor? He doesn't seem to have a job in the second series other than being a blogger and partner to Sherlock.
Yeah, that'd be canonical. I don't think he's working anymore. I don't see him working in season two, to be honest.
And they have clients. I mean, they kind of excuse it with the way that he has his blog, and then they have clients, and they will probably pay them.
He also gets an army pension, more or less. Isn't that suggested somewhere in the originals, even? Or is that just a...
Yeah, he says in the first episode as well, can't afford London on an army pension.
Yeah.
It's completely canonical for him to not have the medical profession any longer.
He goes back to it after.
When he's not feeling the danger, he's got to be doctoring.
Yeah, I wonder if we'll see that he's gone back to it, maybe... when we come back to the series.
With a mustache.
Good point. With a mustache.
Dr. Mustache.
We've seen military John, but we haven't really seen medical John, and that was one of the things that I really wanted and didn't get, so I hope we're going to get it in the next series.
They couldn't just give us all of it in just three episodes. We would have died.
No one could take that much John Watson at once.
Oh, wow.
Sorry, that innuendo just, like, played itself. More proof I shouldn't be drinking before a podcast, but there you go. Brewster North asks, perhaps a bit of a philosophical question. Do we under or overestimate Watson as an unreliable narrator?
Ooh.
That's an amazing question. That's so great, because you know that he's an unreliable narrator. He gets things... there are so many details that are completely... wrong, that have to be wrong within the universe of the stories if you're playing the game. So he must be an unreliable narrator. And ultimately I think it's way more interesting to look at him as an unreliable and perhaps very clever narrator than it is to look at him as a perfectly reliable but bumbling narrator. So I would much prefer the other view of him, because he often says, the world is not ready for this story. I have to protect these clients. These are things that I can't share about Holmes because it would cause us harm. These are things that I can't share about our clients because they would cause our clients harm. The fact that he even wrote up, not to talk about Milverton constantly, but the fact that he wrote up the story in which they're actually housebreaking. And it's brilliant moments where he's saying things that he really shouldn't be if he wanted to keep them out of trouble. And I think that looking at him as an extraordinarily clever sort of weaver of tales that have an enormous amount of truth in them, but are not necessarily truthful in their details or truthful in sort of the names have been changed to protect the innocent sense. That's a much more interesting John Watson to me than one who simply forgot that Holmes was dead in 1892 and dated a case 1892.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of think you were going back to Charles Augustus Milverton. You can kind of almost imagine the conversation behind the lines, you know, when it's published in the Strand, you know, if it was real, the Strand would be like, hey, isn't that case that you said you weren't involved in? And John would just be like, well, you know, I kind of extrapolated. Made up this bit that we broke into the house, but I totally didn't. It's poetic license.
I love that the BBC series has preserved that for us to some extent by, even though obviously they're showing and not telling, by showing us strategic things and concealing strategic things so that many times we get Watson's perspective when and we don't see behind the scenes until they want us to. So I like that feeling.
Yeah, and in the blogs and stuff, they even have that sort of bit saying, we can't reveal this information. Mycroft says I can't. There's censored bits. So they play with that.
Yeah, also, the blog was redated when Series 2 started. The Series 1 cases have been redated, the blog entries. So it's kind of like, they knew they'd written themselves into a corner, but if you're playing the game, it's still completely fine because, you know,
completely canon.
You just cannot trust anything the man says pretty much in public, in his writings or in his blog or publications or whatever universe you have.
It's been argued, actually, that one of the reasons that people are so obsessed with the Sherlock Holmes mysteries to this day is that they're mysteries within mysteries within mysteries. So ostensibly, on the first layer, you have this mystery story where the person shows up at Baker Street and says something inexplicable has happened and I need your help solving it. Within that mystery, there is the mystery of Watson trying to figure out what Holmes is doing to actually solve the case, because John Watson never knows 100% of Sherlock Holmes's mind while he's trying to solve it. And within that mystery, you're wondering how much John Watson is actually telling you of the entire truth because he's totally upfront about the fact that he, you know, alters details to suit his fancy. So you've got layer upon layer upon layer of conundrums that make them just sort of endlessly fascinating for people to study.
So that's actually all the questions we got. The rest are people's favorite Watsons and then the dates, which some of the dates we cannot say on air. But I think that sort of that plays itself to the whole, like, the lady killer aspect of Watson that I think we should talk about, because obviously the BBC runs with that like crazy. Mm-hmm. Like we said before, if you want to kidnap John Watson, send a pretty girl.
And he will come.
He will come.
Wow.
I am 14 years old.
Is this when you said this is your captain speaking?
Yeah. No, the lady killer aspect, because obviously Sherlock Holmes is not interested in like relationships and stuff. Whatever way you want to try and spin it, with whatever, the fact is that the work matters, and if he's gonna be involved in anyone, it's usually for a case or, you know, for his domestic situation. But John Watson is very interested in, you know,
mm-hmm.
he's
divide and
conquer.
You
don't hurt the throw rug.
Someone is in good form tonight.
I completely blame Alistair Duncan. He situates this completely.
I think he was quite excited about what this episode would be about. And, my answer to him on Twitter, which you can go and see if you follow me on Twitter, was fairly inappropriate.
What's John Watson as a lady killer? Obviously, he gets married twice. Mary mm-hmm. Morstan, and then is the other one ever named?
No. The second one is never named, and it's actually only on Holmes's say-so that she exists. It's when he is writing his own account of an adventure because Watson had at the time abandoned me for a wife, the only selfish action I can think of during our long association or something along those lines. And it's interesting because it's much later.
Yeah, no, that could just be Arthur Continuity Doyle.
Arthur, did you just call him Arthur Continuity Doyle?
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Can I just shout out massively for Warrior Bot for giving me that name, because she gave it to me and I gave it to you. So yeah.
That's not my
hello goodness. Warrior Bot, if you're listening.
Seriously, that's brilliant.
Brilliant. I have something to add to the whole John Watson marriage thing.
Yeah.
Because obviously I get the feeling that because he's like a military man and he gets married twice, and it's kind of almost like he's fulfilling that Victorian ideal of like the perfect man, if you know what I mean. He's like been in the military, he's got the mustache, now he needs the wife. But instead, he has Sherlock Holmes. He's like, right. How do I deal with this?
Sherlock Holmes is a terrible wife. He doesn't make sandwiches or anything.
Yeah, no. He's like, I gotta get a real wife now.
And so he goes for Mary Morstan, whose family treasure they've just located. It's kind of a gold digger thing going on there, I think, a little. You're talking about army pension? He's like, she's got money.
But then he says he wouldn't have proposed if the treasure chest had the treasure in it, and it ends up being empty. I love that, Taylor. That's a brilliant like little bit towards the end of Sign of Four. That's really cool.
It's really sweet.
It could just be, you know, oh sure, I wasn't after her money. Reliable narrator.
Meanwhile, Holmes has no such scruples, and the minute he comes back an empty house, buys Watson's practice out from under him through a distant cousin. That's like brilliant.
And in all the stories, Watson's always very kind towards the ladies. Not to say that Holmes isn't. I think in the canon, he's a bit more, you know, conscientious rather than, you know, other updates. Yes, he's very gentlemanly. But he's not above, you know, picking up some random maid and, you know, getting engaged and then just dropping her.
No. I always wonder what happened to her.
I know.
He said she was going to marry the other guy that liked her, so...
She probably died of consumption.
She died of consumption. That's nice.
I find that one of the more cringeworthy moments in the Granada series, actually. Like, it's just so overplayed. It was getting a little late, Granada, and I don't...
Weird
I know, awkward. I am completely on the same page, yes. Yeah.
It's awkward and I love Brett's Holmes, but that scene is awkward in ways that don't make sense.
Yeah, I agree.
Almost as awkward as Martin Freeman with the mustache.
Can I say, I think Martin is perfect to play that aspect of Watson, because obviously, you know, he's not tall like Holmes and, you know, physically striking in the same ways, but he is someone who is so sweet and so adorable that I think it's actually believable that he could, you know, date that many people.
And he does.
I mean, Martin Freeman obviously has a lot of, like, natural charisma that comes through when he's acting. And I don't know how much of that is meant to be John Watson or how much of that is just the Freeman bringing it forth, you know?
Unleash the Freeman.
And I think Jude Law has that as well, that sort of natural charisma as
definitely.
Well. I agree. I really like Watson. I mean, Jude Law and Martin Freeman both bring something very heartwarming to Watson, which, I mean, in other version as well, but if we talk about recently.
He also rocks that mustache quite well.
Well, indeed. And he's very much an equal partner in those films, which I think is great.
Yeah.
That's very
cool. What I like about the modern edit.
That's what I was going to say. I think there is this, they have the heartwarming factor of Watson that, you know, we like. And at the same time, they kind of updated them to a level where they have this kind of, equal strength. Yeah. Even if it's not the same one. They bring their own strengths to a certain parallel with Sherlock Holmes, and it brings this kind of strange balance, kind of yin and yang, even stronger than before. And I think it works really well both in the movies and in the new TV show, even if the movie and the TV show are completely different and completely different character development as well on some levels. It still shows exactly the same core of it, with Watson being this kind of strong man with a heart and a bit of this kind of no-nonsense guy. I mean, one of my favorite things in the Ritchie film is when Watson makes fun of Sherlock Holmes about, you know, the the canoe paddling in on the Thames or something. It's just, yeah. It's just absolutely brilliant. I'm like, dude, it's just throwing you at home. And I'm like, that's, yeah, you just got porn, basically. So yeah. It's just, I really like that. I think there's this, you know, this kind of nice snap thingy going back and forth. And it works also in the BBC version. So it's really great.
I love that. And it's so canonical too. Like at the beginning of The Valley of Fear, there's this moment where Holmes is saying to Watson, he's introducing Professor Moriarty sort of after the fact because Professor Moriarty chronology makes no sense because The Valley of Fear clearly happened before the Reichenbach debacle, and yet John Watson says in The Final Problem that he's never heard of Professor Moriarty. So, you know, whatever. That's just fun times Doyle gave us to play with. But Holmes says, Professor Moriarty as famous among criminals or something like that, and then Holmes fills in for Watson my blushes, which is to say that you were about to say that I am as famous as Moriarty in my own circle, and thank you so much. And then Watson says, I was about actually to say as he's unknown to the public. And here I burn. He literally says a distinct touch. He's like, you're developing a certain pocky sort of strain of humor that I'm going to have to learn to guard against, because that was, oh, snap. He basically just turns and says, snap. Awesome. So, yeah. Watson's there to check Holmes from time to time.
Yeah, and I like to sort of change to a different subject. I like how, especially in the new modern adaptations, like the humor of Watson has been brought up because he does write quite cheekily, and he has a sense of humor, and it hasn't been played in sort of like an intelligent way before. Like has the whole like bumbling bit with Nigel Bruce, but they, and I think especially in BBC that Martin Freeman, how he plays John with that sarcastic humor.
Yeah.
It's very good.
He's just so snarky. I love it. Like, the bit in Baskerville where they're like, oh yeah, we're gonna just walk around your top secret army base. Yeah, come in, let's just spoil the kettle, you know? And just lots of stuff like that. Oh. And he's the kind of person who can really pull that kind of humor off really well as well.
I also like his attribution of the fighting between the Holmes brothers to nicking all of his Smurfs for breaking his accent.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah. We asked people what their favorite Watsons are, and a ginormous amount of people said BBC, of course, and Jude Law. We got some interesting ones that, like, I feel bad because when I made this little graphic, I just picked a bunch of random Watsons. I obviously couldn't put them all, but then some people got, like, really offended when I didn't, you know, put some others. And I feel bad because I missed Vitaly Solomon from the Russian Sherlock Holmes series.
I noticed that.
I feel really bad about that. I'm sorry. Like, Sagita, like, made sure I was very aware that I missed Vitaly Solomon.
Yeah, he's my second favorite.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, a lot of people were like, where's Vitaly? I'm like, I'm sorry, I just added him. It's fine, it's fine. But I want to read what he says, because I think it's really important what Vitaly Solomon actually meant, especially to the Eastern Europeans. Sigita says, the definitive Dr. Watson for millions of people, he is still their doctor. Not sorry about the pun. Seriously. Before David Burke, Arvid Hardwick, there was Vitaly Solomon. Iron Curtain made sure that millions of people knew only about Russian Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson and their adventures. Only after it fell, we discovered Granada series and all the other adaptations. Those were the times, rather recent times. Yeah, for a lot of people, Vitaly was their Dr. Watson, and they weren't aware of any others. So he became very iconic. But I think a lot of people, and I know, Artie, you've talked about this, that his Watson is just very, very good. I personally haven't gotten the chance to watch it yet. Though by seeing, like, GIFs and stuff, I'm just like, I like him. He looks adorable. He has a nice hat.
From what I've seen of the Watson series, he also plays it quite straight, but with that kind of cheeky sense of humor.
Yeah. But he's, like, really impressed. But in a very, like, he wants to learn. And the first thing, I mean, in the first episode, which is, I think, kind of a mix of a study in Scarlet and the Speckled Band.
Yeah.
He's really confused, and they fight it out. I mean, they go to Holmes' bedroom and just start boxing. And that's amazing. Because at that point, they box it out and then they get drunk. And then things are, like, cleared up.
That
and
sounds so Russian.
That's amazing. I love the first part of that. And it's just, and the friendship's kind of established. I love that.
And I love how three-dimensional he is, because I think now we've had series two, and so Martin's Watson has really come into his own, so I'm happy with that. But before that was, like, Vitaly Solomon was still, like, the most three-dimensional Watson for me.
Yeah.
Because you can see the military man, you can see the doctor, and you can see the educated man. And again, going back to that first episode, because the bit of it that is studying Scarlet, which is obviously where they first meet. And you know how in the canon, Watson makes all these detailed lists of Holmes' skills and limitations, and he spends a long time trying to figure out what it is that his flatmate does for a living. Yeah. And he does that in the Russian series as well, and half of the time he is actually convinced that there's something illicit going on, that Holmes is some kind of criminal mastermind.
Yeah.
And I absolutely adore that twist that they show, like, his, you can see the cogs turning there, and you can see the thinking process and the concern and just everything. He's lovely, he's wonderful. So if you get the chance, go give him a go, because he's fabulous.
Yeah, and it's really amazing, because if you're not familiar with the stories, then of course you only know what Watson sees, right? Because they don't give it away what Holmes actually does. So until Watson realizes that this strange man with the beard is actually Holmes coming out of his bedroom, we don't know that either. So that is really cool. Follow that mystery in the beginning.
Was I being horribly American by calling him Vitaly instead of, like, Vitaly? Yeah.
We forgive you.
He's not from the mafia. Vitaly Solomon. My apologies to Russia and Eastern Europe. The next one I got from Lofgren. Sorry if I can't pronounce your Tumblr name. Ian Hartz Watson from Silk Stocking.
Oh.
Oh dear.
It's just that Rupert Everett is so, like, punchable in that movie. I hardly look at Watson.
That's good.
Just my two cents, sorry.
Yeah, and Ian Hart was Watson also in the BBC Hound of the Baskervilles with Richard Roxburgh, really all kinds of not good, you know?
Yeah, not good at all.
I mean, the drug use and whatnot, and just,
Both Roxburgh's Holmes and I think Rupert Everett's Holmes, I'm just going to do the inner monologue for a second, which was anger, brood, drugs, anger, brood. Like, there were no levels to it. They were such angst monsters. And it was like, there was no joy in the relationship. I think that Sherlock Holmes is an enormously angsty character, don't get me wrong, but, like, if there's no joy in the relationship, then what are you watching?
Sorry, Lofgren.
Although Ian Hart, I have no problem with the Watson. It's just that he was paired with some of the Holmeses that I have been taken a little more exception to in recent years, I guess.
Well, I was talking about this on the last debate. I think it's like, I just could not see why Watson would hang around these people at all.
The converse of the other question. Why would Holmes hang around Watson if he's an idiot?
No, that was what I was going to say, because it's just like, what is he getting out of this relationship? Like, and you constantly just want to say to him, you know, go, Watson, run from the scary man.
So the next one we got, that's a bit obscure, is from The Amazing Sketch, and was the Watson from Holmes in the 22nd Century on there.
Oh,
the animated series.
The robot.
Was he a robot?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh.
Really?
Well, Holmes has been reanimated, and Watson is a robot because they know that Holmes can't function without Watson, but Watson has basically, they've downloaded all the original canon into his hard drive. Am I getting this right?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So that's the Watson from the 22nd century. It's you.
You should give that show a go at one point, because it's crocktastic. Awesome. Really, really good.
Make, like, an awesome drinking game out of it or something.
Oh, yeah.
So, Matthew Sherlock Jean's Dr. Dawson. Yeah!
Yeah,
even Q Dawson. Oh, yes. Who wants to say something? Yes.
No, that's just the noise I make when I think about Dawson.
He's a mouse. An animated mouse. No, I love Dr. Dawson. I think he's... I totally had a... Is it weird as a... No, it's a child, so it's... Shut up! No. As a child, you're allowed to have, you know...
Crushes on...
Yes! I was in love with Basil Baker Street, but like, yeah. I wanted Dr. Dawson to be, like, my uncle, who, like, brought me, like, sweets and stuff.
Cause... All right, Christina, you're not alone there. But I think we shouted off those yeah. furries, so...
Great movie.
No! That was amazing. I thought he was so awesome.
Yes.
He's wonderful. Is it a spoiler to talk about the Radigan-Moriarty connection? Is that
no,
a spoiler?
No.
Oh my god, that was brilliant.
Oh, so good. No, the Reichenbach-esque scene and
yeah, wait,
Great
wait,
Mouse
wait.
Detective.
That has to kind of...
No, no. Cavers, it's a Reichenbach. You know what happened. We're talking about Great Mouse Detective. Don't worry. Benedict Cumberbatch is not a mouse.
Spoilers,
I know. No, but that whole connection, Lindsay, like, it's great. And, like, they play with it. And, like, as a kid, I didn't realize it. But I'm sure, like, watching it as an adult, you're like, look at this. This is great. Because they have, like, Dawson, he's from Afghanistan, he's a surgeon, like, it's great, I love it. And he has a little boiler hat.
Yeah, it's brilliant. That movie's awesome.
One day, I will make people talk about The Great Mouse Detective with me. Like.
Well, they're based on books, too, and it's been years since I read the books. And now I'm not going to remember who wrote them, which is terrible. Children's series.
Yeah, I looked on Amazon, but they were, like, out of print, and I couldn't get it.
Mm-hmm. They're very, very different from the film, though. Or series in tone and things.
And apparently in the books, Basil thinks he can play the violin, but he actually can't.
Just like in BBC.
Oh, he tries.
I'm sorry.
If you listen to the commentary on Belgravia, Benedict is like, everything about that's wrong, and I feel really bad. But he only
I love that he mentioned that. That redeemed him.
Because that is
okay,
hard.
Okay, God, noticed that too.
It's hard.
Okay. Wikipedia says they were written by Eve Titus.
Thank you.
Dear people awesome. Who are listening, if anyone wants to buy me these books, or if you have these books, you can send them to me. Just email me, please, at curly@bigstreetbabes.com. Thank you.
Maybe they'll put them back into print.
Okay. Moving on to favorite Watsons. We are going into Granada now. Louisa, my favorite Watson moments are the ones in which he defies Holmes, like not letting him go into Cam or trying to examine him, the dying detective. I think Edward Hardwick will forever be my favorite on-screen Watson. Yes, so Edward Hardwick and David Burke obviously shared the role. And I know, I think maybe it was in the first episode already that you said you couldn't decide which one you liked better.
Yeah, and it's still a tie. I mean, obviously Edward Hardwick did more episodes, but obviously as the series goes on, like the late Granada is a bit painful to watch for all kinds of reasons, but that's not really his fault. With David Burke, he's so smiley and optimistic and good-natured. But yeah, earlier today, I just rewatched Empty House and The Dying Detective with Edward Hardwick to just, you know, remind myself of his Watson, because I haven't really watched any of them in ages. And he brings different parts to the character than David Burke does, but they're both great.
I love how much joy, as you were just saying, there is in David Burke's portrayal. He so captures the, I think him and Martin Freeman both own this quality of that was amazing. Just where everything about them, when they look at Holmes, when they see him do something incredible and they say that was amazing, it was amazing. And it's so infectious. I think that Burke and Freeman both capture that in ways that a little bit Law doesn't. He gets a sort of, I've seen this before.
Yeah, he doesn't have that amazement.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite bit of Burke Watson is probably the beginning of Resident Patient, where they're in the barbershop together. And he tries to deduce Holmes and says, well, you know, you're only out of the house because Mrs. Hudson is doing the spring cleaning and she's been nagging you for days to get outside so she can get it done. And Holmes is like, no, you know, you're talking, this is not the reason at all why I'm in the barbershop, but maybe actually it is.
It's totally right.
They have this lovely conversation, and Burke Watson's just, he's so smiley because he knows he's got it right, like, from the very start, but he plays along. Yeah, he's very charming.
He lights up in ways that are so, you know, it's just fun to watch.
Like, at the beginning of The Red-Headed League, when they're sitting there trying so hard not to laugh at this person.
Yeah, and Edward Hardwick has this more settled, more grounded quality, like with him you more get the feeling that he's the stable part, like, the person who gets there to do damage control when Holmes is, you know, doing something that's not very wise. And that's why he is so great in episodes like Dying Detective, for instance.
Yeah, or Devil's Foot.
Before we go on to BBC, because I'm sure that's going to, you know, take up a long time, on our Tumblr when we posted about the appreciation episode, someone named Destadora wrote this amazing post looking at all the Watsons and their importance. It's really long, so I won't read it here, but everyone can go on to our Tumblr, bigstreetbabes.tumblr.com, and read it. I highly recommend it. It's really quite lovely. So thank you, Destadora, for that. And probably the Watson that was nominated the most as people's favorites was Martin Freeman's from BBC. At this point, Catherine, you may want to say whatever you want now, and then I'm going to tell you to fuck off. Because we're going to get into my fuck feelings.
The thing is, I've probably said a lot of, like, my appreciation for Martin Freeman, John Watson, like, in other episodes, so I will try and paraphrase very quickly. His facial expressions and body acting is amazing, and he just is a very likeable character. You just watch it and you think, I wish I lived with John and Sherlock. But he also has that, he's very, he plays it very human. Like, he's not perfect, you know, he's not kind of, he's meant to look like the normal man compared to Sherlock, but even he has, like, sometimes has a bit of short temper, and, you know, there is a lot of, like, dimensions to his character as well. He gets pissed off at an end machine, which I completely sympathize with, because I get angry at the end machines all the time. Yeah, he becomes more, like, laid back as the series goes on and kind of accepts all the really weird stuff that happens in his life, like, you know, when a car pulls up to take him away, he just gets in. It could be from anyone. And yeah, no, I just, yeah, I had nothing else to say, really. Just okay. Sit here and be like, oh.
Well, go away. I don't know. Go away. I'll text you when we want you back. Oh, she's gone. You know. So, Martin Freeman's John Watson. The heart that his portrayal has. And I just realized we skipped over Jude Law, but we'll just go back to him. The heart that Martin Freeman's John Watson has, that people have always made to say, like, I'll burn the heart out of you line is referring to John, whether it is or not. But that he is always that backer for Sherlock, that he, and this, I mean, especially in Reichenbach, like, he doesn't believe that Sherlock was a fraud, and he wants to, like, make sure everyone knows that he protects Sherlock, he defends him, because
he has faith in Sherlock Holmes, he believes in Sherlock Holmes. I talked to people online about this a lot, and, you know, one person was saying that when Sherlock tries to disprove it, by saying, you know, I just researched you, you know, and John's like, the first time we met, you knew everything about my sister. Well, if we cast our minds back to studying Pink, actually Sherlock thought it was a brother. If he'd researched John, he wouldn't have made that mistake.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So John knows for a fact. Like, it's not just that he has blind faith. He knows for a fact that Sherlock's deductions are not always perfect, and if he was a fraud who researched people, they would be. And that is why he believes in Sherlock Holmes, because, you know, it's not just faith. It's like, he knows.
I think one of my favorite things about Martin's Watson is that I think it makes him such a strong character that he knows he can appreciate someone without it diminishing him. He can give so much appreciation to Sherlock and so much affection and be so vulnerable and show his weaknesses, but it doesn't diminish him at all. And he realizes that, you know, making some sacrifices for the friendship and being there for Sherlock isn't going to take away from him. It's going to add to him. And I think that makes that character really beautiful.
And he's a warrior in a sense. That's exactly it. He's a warrior who needs something. He needs a cause, in a way. And I think that Watson in particular really brings home the idea that John Watson would rather be making a difference in the world, a palpable difference, in a really visceral way, than collecting a wound pension and treating people with the sniffles. He's a man of action, and Martin Freeman really captures the idea that Watson needs Holmes as well, as much as Holmes needs Watson to ground him and to be, in the BBC version, almost a sort of conscience in a sense, because the BBC version can tend to be a little bit more extreme than the canon version by all means. But I like that Watson needs that antagonism against the dark side and that Holmes brings him that.
One of the things I like as well about BBC Watson, White's strength, which is this kind of underlying, there is, it's a combination of many things. I mean, it's a known fact that Watson is a man, you know, is loyal, he's been in the army, he's brave, but he has a history. He had traumas in his life, and there are many things that combine together, but I feel that the BBC version brought this kind of sense of threats inside Watson, which is, be careful what you're doing, because he's actually stronger than you might think, even stronger than what you might imagine. And I feel like it's actually, I mean, I'm going to make a side comment on that, but I always thought it was very smart to cast Martin Freeman as Watson for that very reason, is that most people, in a way, didn't expect someone who was working in comedies and doing a lot of more like light movies to actually bring that kind of strength. A blessing for us, the audience, because we get more for the character, but we get also more from an actor that wasn't necessarily the one that people were thinking about. So I think the strengths come from both things. It comes from the evolution of the character in the show as is, and also from the fact that they found someone as like Martin Freeman, who basically just stunned everyone into, oh my god, what just happened? We didn't know we could do that. And I think that's really interesting, because it was probably legitimate from, you know, Gacy's and Moffat to actually go in a place where the man playing John Watson would bring this element of surprise as well. And I think it works really well, and it gives the quiet strength that John needs in the context of the modern Sherlock Holmes and everything.
Yeah, so even if you think of the beginning, I mean, what we see, how we get to know him, it's crying, right? It's crying John Watson. That's the first time we meet him, is him being weak. And then we have this character development. And we see him as a really, really strong man, but, you know, in the beginning, he's everything but. So I find that a really interesting way of introducing him. Because, of course, that's not the way that canon introduces Watson. And it's interesting because it's kind of such an intimate way of getting to know the character.
There's a little bit of In a Study in Scarlet where Watson admits that he has shattered nerves, sort of he objects to rows, he says, because his nerves are all in pieces. So he has, even in the canon, it's not visible, but it's a little PTSD-ish, and he ends up being quite shaken by the mystery in this scene, close to the end of, they're close to solving it, and Watson says to Holmes that the mystery and the suspense of A Study in Scarlet, the case they were working on, the Jefferson Hope case, was much more disturbing to him than seeing his comrades hacked to pieces, he says literally, in Afghanistan, because at this point his nervous system is having a hard time coping with civilian life.
Yeah, but then again, he was also drifting at the start of canon, wasn't he? Like, living in a hotel and squandering his money, and then realizing that maybe he should sort his act out, and then he met Mike Stanford, and the rest is history. But,
which makes the BBC moment so poignant when he says, "I was so alone," because that's so true. But it's so true in the canonical sense and in the BBC sense, and it's just heartbreaking because he was so alone before meeting this other person who was also alone, who by his own admission, save yourself, I have no friends. And it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I find it really excruciating to watch that end, because you get this whole character development for John, but then you go back to the beginning. He goes back to what he was like before Sherlock. His entire body language shifts. I just sat there, and that was the most, not even the words that he said, but just watching him move, watching the thing with his hand that he does, and the posture and the limp and
Yeah, when you see him, like, his face goes back to that soldier mentality. Like, you see it happening, because that's the only thing he knows outside of Sherlock. Like, that's all he's got.
Fast to, like, what he was like in Baskerville, because in Baskerville he was having the time of his life and being the confident army person who can pull rank and knows Morse code, and, you know.
Good luck that to him.
You literally see physically this character shut back down without even, regardless of what is said, you literally watch it happen.
Which I found missing a bit from the Warner Brothers version.
Yeah. That did miss a bit. Like, he's obviously quite sad, and, like, you get the sort of depression.
Yeah,
when
but,
you,
yeah, that's
but
true.
You do, you don't I, see him. Yeah, it's a very different reactions.
It doesn't contrast really well either with the way that Watson reacts in the scene where Holmes is like dying in the boxcar either.
Right. Yeah.
That extremely emotional thing that happens to him in that sequence, and then when the actual moment comes at the end where he really thinks his friend is dead, it's not, it doesn't have the same kind of effect, and you kind of expect it to.
For me, if we're talking about the movie, for me it's like it's a massive error from a directorial direction point of view to have not have this sense of loss for Watson in the movie. Like there is when we switch from one scene to the other, it goes way too fast, and it's too bad because you had a glimpse of that in the train, and they didn't take it further at the end of the movie. And that's probably one of the things I missed the most in the film, was like give us grief, give us something. Instead of that, they cut it so fast, and then they went immediately toward the end. So it was like, why?
I was actually okay with that, just because I think because we had gotten the emotional scene, and because we as the viewers, at least those of us who know what happened, know that he's not actually dead there. So it's like, I think we had already seen Watson's emotions play out, and I also think this Watson is in a different point in his life in some ways, because even without Holmes, he has a wife at this point. He has a life to go back to. So, as much as he would have that sense of loss, I feel like if they weren't going to leave the ending ambiguous, which I kind of was hoping for, even though I figured they wouldn't, I think I was actually okay with that quick cut there, because I almost think it would have been repetitive given what we had seen in the boxcar. I did think it was an interesting choice to include a near death earlier on, and then to have the Reichenbach scene at the end. I thought that was kind of a strange to have both of those there.
I thought it was just interesting in terms of confusing the audience as well, because, you know, most people who go and see the Ritchie movies, okay, some of them might have not read the book, some of them might not know what's supposed to happen, but half of the audience, let's say half, actually knows what's going to happen. So when he went there for maybe a very short moment, even if we knew Holmes wasn't going to die, most of our heart just skipped a bit for a second, just like, oh my god, what the hell is going on here? And I thought it was a nice twist in a way that, you know, people are expecting to see something, especially in Victorian steampunk. But, you know, it was like, in a way, when the first time I saw the movie, I was like, oh, what is going on here? And I just had this kind of tiny bits of like, oh, surprise, because I was not expecting that so early. And I think it's a good, it was kind of a fun idea. It's still a movie. I mean, that's one of the things I always want to say to some people. It's like, let's not forget it's a movie, and movie has its own language as well. So it's interesting to have some twists and plots that are a bit different from what people are expecting, especially adapting something that is so well known. So I kind of like that, but I would have loved to see a bit more of grief at the end, a sense of time passing by, and where you go to that place where you're actually, you know, mourning for someone.
Yeah, it seems like it's been about a week and a half, and then all sunshine
again. You really don't know, and you know it's not because they have to come back from, they have to do the funeral and stuff. But it's just, I don't know. There is a strange feeling of going too fast, and I know why they wanted the comic relief at the end, but it was maybe a bit too soon. I mean, this I've said it in the podcast before. I think the final scene in Aegos should have been after the credits.
Yeah, yeah,
That would have been perfect. Because you would end it in absolute horror, like Empire Strikes Back drama. And then
that would have been fantastic.
Yeah, and then you just watch the credit, and then suddenly, the little extra scene at the end. And the
like
people
a button.
And the people who would have missed it would have been like, oh my god, what have I missed? And it would have been crazy. But it would have brought this sense of hope in a very movie-based idea, which would have been
fun. Yeah, and it would have put some space in between the end and...
Yeah.
I think I'm evil. I want people who don't know what happens to suffer at the end and like not know.
I was shocked they actually showed him at the end of the Reichenbach fall. I was shocked. Yeah. I didn't expect them to show Cumberbatch as being alive.
Oh, but fucking Christ, thank God they did. Like, I know, because Marie, Artie, and I, we were all there, and like, you could just feel like the horror of like what we were watching, because like John is breaking. And the moment that fucking coat collar came in, we started screaming.
I was standing because I wasn't there to finish the Reckonback podcast, so I couldn't say that. But I was literally standing in Christina's living room, holding a cushion, swearing in just about 5 different languages. Yes. And just standing there, I was completely stunned. And I didn't even know what I was saying. I can't remember what I was saying.
You were just screaming and dancing.
Yeah, that was just, it was very awkward. There was probably too much wine and chocolate and ice cream all together. I had a bit of a sugar shock, blanket shock, everything shock.
I was crushing my forearm, who's like barely a Sherlockian, just a very, you know, sort of tolerant person. And I'm like, no, God!
Unlike the movie, though, I feel like that did not diminish the sadness of what Watson was going through. Yeah. And I think that's what we all probably would have liked to see more of in the film, is that feeling of bittersweetness that we see him alive, but we're still sad for Watson.
That's because Robert Downey Jr.'s Holmes, he's being silly. Yeah. And you sort of get that Watson has this idea that Holmes is alive from this, and it's all there. It's very, you know, happy-go-lucky, yada, yada.
Yeah,
but you see Cumberbatch's Sherlock, he is sad that this has happened. Like, he's really upset. He realizes what he's done to John and to, like, everyone. Nothing about how Reichenbach ends is, you know, happy or silly or giving you any sort of hope, actually.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that's really striking, I mean, obviously, again, it's probably, you know, it's talked about in previous podcasts, but one of the things that I thought was really striking in the BBC version is how vocal John is about his loss, which is most of the time in Sherlock Holmes adaptation, it's expressed through the writing. As in, John writes about Holmes. He might mention it, but it's about the writing, it's about the stories. Whereas, again, I'm going back to what I was saying earlier, which was the quiet strength. It takes a lot of bravery to actually stand and say things out loud, even if you're alone in front of a graveyard. John, in the Sherlock BBC version, what makes it absolutely heartbreaking is the absolute commitment he has to Sherlock as a friend, and the fact that he's standing there and he's vomiting words about him and say, just come back. And that's something that is so, I mean, I'm gonna expand it even further than that. We're talking John Watson, but we're also talking guy character in general. Which are more restrained in the way they talk about their feelings. And what they did with John Watson in Sherlock BBC is actually even above the John Watson's character development. It's about taking a man and making him so, like, it's broken, but it's strong, and it's everything all together. Excruciating. And that's why everyone was just in tears, because, again, Martin Freeman, thank you. It was just beautiful, and on so many levels. Above there was the Sherlock level, there was the canon level, and there was the man Cray level. There was everything that you don't necessarily see, and that's why it's so powerful. And I think that's what makes it stunning.
Beautiful, and that is the guy in the canon who says, "It is my greatest joy and privilege to help you." Yeah. That is why I'm around, is because we are a team, and the things we do are important. And that, it just, they owned it in that episode.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Yeah. Should we invite Catherine back?
Maybe come back.
That was a weird psychic moment. I just went onto Twitter to see how you guys, Skype to see how you guys are doing, and you just called me. It's so weird.
We got it all out. It's good. The next part for a bit of silliness now. Since we just got emotional, we asked people on Tumblr and Twitter and Facebook, if you could take John Watson on a date, one, which one, and where would you go? Some of you are very creative. Some of you...
I like the use of brackets in this. Some of you were very swing, creative.
We got, like, a lot of feedback on it, so we obviously can't say them all. First, there's some general ones, and then we'll get into, you know, which Watson. Again, Freeman's Watson was the most popular, but we got some interesting ones too. There you go. So, actually, I'm going to ask all of us first, because actually someone wanted to know, one, who's our favorite John Watson? So I'm going to ask everyone, who's your favorite John Watson, and which John Watson would you take on a date, and what would you do? Okay, Amy, go.
Okay, my favorite Watson is Martin Freeman. And I think I would just love to have an evening in because I think he is such a comfortable Watson and somebody that you could enjoy just spending one-on-one quality time with. Keeping and watching telly.
Maria.
Well, I'll join those two.
Okay, Taylor. Oh my God!
Suddenly we're all going on an adventure to John's house to watch telly as a group. Great.
He'd like
that. Sounds
it.
Like a plan.
Well, I'm sure he would. I would definitely say Freeman too, though. For both my favorite and the one I would want to go out with. And I agree. He just looks so cuddly. I just want to cuddle him.
Catherine.
It's a pretty difficult question, actually. My favorite Watson, predictably, is probably Martin Freeman. He's fantastic. And while I wouldn't say no, I am also a heightist. And I know for a fact that Jude Law is taller than me. very often. So I would have to say that the date, unfortunately, falls to Watson. as to what we would do, since probably that would either involve time travel on my part or his part. He'd definitely rock a dress and would go and see an old ballet.
Right.
I'll let your imaginations run wild with that one.
Alright,
Artie. Right, okay, as for favourites, I am honestly, every time I get asked this question, I'm like, I want to say David Burke, but I like Martin Freeman as well, and I like Vitaly Solomon, and I really, really like Ivan Harburg, so I honestly cannot choose, like, you know, that there's about four or five that I really, really like. And the kind of the chart list of numbers, who is the first and who's the second, kind of varies. So I'm sorry about that. But as for taking on a date, I would take Martin Freeman Watson on a date. And I'd take him to the Science Museum in London, in Kensington, to the medicine exhibit, because I think that would be really interesting and we'd talk a lot.
Lindsay?
Oh, God, I'm in the same boat. With Artie, it's like, so many of them have chunks of my heart. So I'm gonna have to, I'll give a totally cop-out answer and say Canon Watson, is my favorite. I wanna go on a date with Canon Watson because he encompasses all of the gorgeous qualities and, prevents me from having to choose one Watson from among the others. And he was really into the horse races. So I think we should go to the horse races together, bet on the ponies, and have a beer. That's my plan.
Marie?
Well, obviously, my favorite Watson is Martin Freeman, but for obvious reason, I will go in a very different way that hasn't been mentioned any time in this podcast. I will take gender swap Watson on a date, which is, if I remember correctly, from a very old Russian TV show, because, yeah, it's a woman.
That was also a Rex Stout article in the Baker Street Journal. Baker Street Journal shout out. I believe it was published in there at one point, but Rex Stout gave a talk at a BSI dinner at one point where he claimed Watson was a woman.
Yay. So
Random.
Yeah, I'm just, I can't remember because we haven't mentioned it, but I can't remember what's the name of the show, but I know a lot of people are posting old videos of it on Tumblr with, where Sherlock and Watson are women. And yes. it looks really fun. So I just thought I would make a nice shout out to this one as well. And yeah, gender swap Watson, woman. Oh yeah.
What would you do?
Oh, I don't know. What a question. Oh God! I don't
know.
Go
exactly
to
what you do.
Go to the theater. That's there what I'm. That's so original. I'm so predictable as a person. That's brilliant.
Alright, Sarah.
Okay. I am going to give David Burke some props because he was my first TV Watson, and his sort of gentle exasperation with Holmes. And when I first saw Reichenbach, I had not read that far in the stories. So his pain there was my horror that this person I had come to love had died and I didn't know he was coming back.
Oh, that's terrible. But,
let me dump all of my sorrow on you now. but for a date, I think I would take Martin Freeman Watson out, something very relaxed, and I'm rubbish at dates, so I would say I would let him choose, but he's not terribly creative either from what we've seen. So I may have to join all the rest of you in Amy's living room.
I'm going to answer my own question unless someone wants to ask me.
Yes, Christina, who is your favorite Watson, and who would you take on a date, and what would you do?
Favorite Watson is Martin Freeman's. I'm going to jump on that boat and party on it. As for the one... speaking of, I think the one that I would take on a date would be Jude Law's Watson, actually. I will join. Yeah. And for what we would do, I don't know.
See, it's hard, isn't it?
See, it's hard, yeah. It's like, I don't even have any idea.
Well, first I would jump in the TARDIS and go back to 1890. I'd say 91, maybe. And we'd go to Paris, and we'd walk along the Seine and have crepes. That's what we would do. Because if I was in the Victorian age, I wouldn't have to be vegan.
You could knit him a scarf.
Yes, I'll knit him a scarf. So when we ask people what they would do and who they would take, we got a whole bunch of answers. These ones are a bit general. Flawed Amethyst said paintballing, no contest. I assume she means Martin Freeman's Watson.
Yeah, she does.
She's not going to be taking Nigel Bruce out paintballing.
Although I'd need to see that.
Oh, Mr. E. Sundance said, I would take him to my place, have a beer and watch telly. Watson is so laid back. I think we can assume which one. J. Harris Calver, cinema date to watch the Guy Ritchie film.
Interesting.
Yeah. Brewster
Inception.
Norris. Inception. Watson. Brewster Norris says Rainbow Room at the Rockefeller Center. And be spectacate to heaven and back.
Oh, ouch.
Ah. We actually got someone who said they'd want to take out Paget's Watson. Yes, Sidney Paget's illustration of Watson, saying he is so damn hot in capital.
See, that's really interesting, because now I wonder immediately which one. Those different illustrations, you're looking at these guys, and there's this range.
Which size mustache do you want?
Like, I love the one in my head is sort of the one in the train car on their way to Silver Blaze, and Holmes is wearing the truly regrettable hat, but then it's the one he's leaning over with his fingertips on his palm talking to Watson. Like, that one seems pretty typical, but some of them are widely divergent. That's a cool answer, but I wonder which one.
Two for Granada. A Journal of Impossible Things says, regarding Watson dates, I take out Burke Watson out on the town in modern day London, just to experience his wide-eyed, endearingly overacted Great Scott reactions to everything, like cars, cell phones, skyscrapers, etc. It would be adorable, and I'd probably ask him if I could touch his mustache.
There's some kind of mustache fetish going on this podcast right now.
I am into that.
Okay, so I don't read them all. I'm going to put one in the chat box, and Taylor, you're going to read this one out. It's also from Mundos de Papel.
Says, I love, capital letters on love, all Watts, but I'd say Granada Watts, specifically Ed Hardwick. The problem with BBC and Ritchie vs. Watsons is that they have a very cock-blocking Sherlock, so a date would always go wrong with any of them. While Granada and Rush and Holmes are more relaxed about John having a life of their own. Besides, I like gentlemen. We should go to the theater or the opera and then dinner. Classy, intelligent, and romantic. I like that she figured in the cock-blocking Sherlocks as... I just want to deal with that.
It's very true, though. Okay, Marie, you have this one.
Okay, so time-traveling dandy said, simple... I'd be Jude Law Watson. I'd take advantage of his gambling habit with the game of Victorian street poker, but only if the bulldog wasn't in the room. That is a very good answer.
Alright, Artie, you have this one because you know what it is.
Right. This is where I grab the cold shower, basically. Carnival of the Random. Hello, Kristen. BBC Watson... with Ritchie vs. Watson as a second choice. Activity, dark dining. Because sensory deprivation creates a slight adrenaline rush, it's a heightened sensual experience while still in a nominally secure and predictable milieu. Plus, It can foster a sense of intimacy with whomever one is with. All of which are things I think would suit Watson's temperament and inclinations.
Wow.
All right, so we've moved on to BBC now. Maria, I'm giving you this one.
From Pocky Fox. If I could take BBC Watson on a date, I'd probably ask him to play London tour guide for a day. I'd love to take in a mix of ridiculous touristy things, as well as perhaps getting to see him, getting to see some of his personal favorite parts of the city. I haven't got to spend nearly as much time in London as I would like, and it would be absolutely fantastic to rectify that in good company of cuddly little badass motherfuckers.
Oh, bam, for the people who don't.
And then, Sarah, I'll give you this one.
Oh my god.
My heart in hiding says, I would take BBC John roller skating. God knows he could use the silliness, especially when it's time for the traditional hokey pokey under the mirror ball. When I would fall, which would be often as I'm unsteady on skates, he would catch me. Smooching might ensue.
Aww. Smiley Aww. Face. And then we got two, like, novel-length ones. They're just so long, but they're so funny. Oh, but no. I may just have to post them because they're just really long.
Yeah.
It's a D. Dwayne, and we'll post it on Tumblr.
Yeah.
D. Dwayne and then War of the Roses, who actually wrote the Ballad of John Watson and Me. So, we have our last minute John Watson feelings.
Okay, I have some John Watson feelings.
Okay. Express your John Watson feelings.
It's gonna be extremely collateral, but I really want to make a shout out for it. Can I just make a shout out for Trudy, who spent the past months knitting the Christmas jumper of John Watson in Scandal in Belgravia. And he looks amazing, so I'm gonna have lots of feelings when I'm gonna get it. That's it.
So I have to say that I still have fantasies about having the military jacket that the Jude Law Watson wears in the first film.
Oh, yeah.
Where he comes in. I think I ended up making up this funny, like, joke with some of my friends about, like, you know, him featuring in What Ho magazine, which would be the Victorian version of Hello magazine.
Is it any
relationship
to Cheekbone magazine?
You know, it'd be like Sherlock Holmes was seen, you know, this evening here, and his companion was wearing a rather spiffing jacket, and this is where you can buy your own.
It's a good transition to say there is an exhibition right now in London about costumes and designs and stuff for Sherlock Holmes 2 as well.
Yes.
For anyone who is around, can't remember where it is, but yeah, I think we mentioned it on Twitter.
University of Arts in London is doing it, so we're going.
Can I say Martin's Watson has become the Watson in my head canon when I read the originals, obviously in a Victorian context, but I think just his level of irony and humor and the balance he brings to it, I think it has even added something to my experience of reading the canon. So thank you to the BBC and Martin Freeman for enriching my reading experience.
I agree. I have so much more.
I do hear his voice now when I read stuff as well. It's really strange. It's bizarre. It's like he's shifted or something.
But it's really
well,
cool.
Well done.
See, I've got Jude Law in my head. It's this weird thing because I think I have Benedict as Sherlock Holmes, but Victorianized, and then I have Jude Law as his Watson. It's very bizarre.
That could be fun.
I want to shout out to Jude Law's limp, by the way.
Oh yeah,
that's brilliant.
Yeah,
I mean, and he didn't have to pay that much attention. There was no, you know, and it was awesome. I enjoyed that.
I enjoyed a lot of things about Jude Law.
Well, indeed. Well, indeed.
let's just make a small thing. It's actually one in the morning in the UK right now. I think our captain is slowly drifting away in the land of dreams with Jude Law.
Yes.
On that note, guys, I think it's time for me to go to bed now.
Okay. Good night, Catherine. Good night.
Good night.
Bye.
Right, by way of last-minute John Watson feelings, can I just say thank you very much for Randomized Habit, who came to the meetup last weekend and emailed me beforehand and suggested we go to the Hunterian Museum at the Royal College of Surgeons.
And the upper gallery there is all about battlefield surgery. So in Watson terms, it was very interesting for any period in history because it went from the 19th century right back around to the present day. So all kinds of Watson stuff and battlefield surgery things, very interesting.
Yeah, the meetup was fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm so jealous. I didn't get to be there this year.
I just want to say it because, you know, it's worth saying, and it was absolutely amazing. It was just so lovely to see everyone, talk to everyone, and everyone was having a good time. There was a lot of smiling, giggling, laughing, and it just felt so cool. And again, I think it reminds all of us how amazingly united and everything it has created, especially in the past 2 years because of the show, bringing that together as well. And thanks everyone who came. Thank you so much, Ardy, for organizing it. Yay! You are a star. It was brilliant. Thank you so much. And thanks to everyone who was listening to this and who came. It was absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it definitely brought the communities really together right now. And I just, like, for an update from my point of view, I wanted to thank everyone who reblogged the Tumblr post a few weeks back about I found the post-it note that said I believe in Sherlock downtown here in my city. I found the person responsible.
Oh yeah.
And yay. I started a Charleston Sherlock meetup group, and now we're up to 12 people.
Oh
yeah. We're meeting on Saturday for the first time. So I literally spent my day to day doing buying stupid things, like I bought little plastic magnifying glasses at a party store and stuff, and I'm ready to go. And it's like, you know, I can't believe there's so many people who are fans here. You know, it's just, so thank you to everyone who passed that on, because I definitely found where my fans are at.
That's brilliant. See, that's amazing.
Yeah, a lot of people have been like tweeting us and stuff saying like, how do you start your own group? Where can you find them? And there's lists of like societies and stuff, but I mean, if you go to the Sherlock Meetup Live Journal community, or if you just go on Facebook or on Tumblr, has been really great. Just be like, I live here. Who's around? Who wants to meet up? And people will find you. The internet community is really great for that. And I think all these meetups that are happening, especially now, are really, really fantastic. And if you have a group and if you want us to sort of give us a signal boost, we can do that for you. We're starting to have reach, and it's exciting.
There's been a lot of brilliant, like, collisions of different groups recently, too. Like, I was at Ash Wednesday, the Adventuresses of Sherlock Holmes meet every first Wednesday at O'Casey's here in New York, and Sherlock NYC came, which was great. Yay. So Sherlock NYC was there, and Jen couldn't be there because she had to work, but it was brilliant. And so, you know, you have a lot of folk who are meeting other... It's easier in New York, granted, but there's a lot of people who are meeting up with other groups and just sort of turning into this giant Sherlockian love splooge, and I think it's fantastic.
Love splooge, it's a great word. And then the picture that we did at the meetup, which has over, like, I think 6,300 notes at the moment, which is so cool.
That was amazing.
Yeah. That was such a great moment.
And so the people that lived across the street came running down to take pictures.
It's just you coming around the corner and going like, holy shit.
There was a lot of people there.
Yeah.
How many were we? 60. We were about 60?
I felt a lot of love from that picture. That was just brilliant. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people who weren't able to be there, I think, just, you know, took a gander at it and thought that, yeah, that's what it's about.
Yeah, like a lot of people have been very sweet about it, which makes it good that I don't feel bad about almost killing all my flatmates by spray painting in like a closed room. Be like, this is a good idea. Like, I just keep taking breaks after like each like five panels, just being like, I feel funny. It was all done with love. So in short, John Watson, fucking awesome. Lots of love.
I believe in shadow ghosts. If this quotidian world has got you crying, won't you too?